Welcome to an enlightening podcast from IslamPodcasts.com. We encourage our listeners to please comment and let us know how we can grow in our knowledge to better serve our community. Please remind your family and friends to also visit IslamPodcasts.com for engaging discussions on current events, Islamic guidance, Quran, tafsir, seerah, and much more. Thank you for listening to this podcast. Podcasts on current events, Islamic guidance, Quran tafsir, and seerah are available at islampodcasts.com as well as on iTunes. Rate, review, and comment and let us know how we can grow in our knowledge to better serve our community. Please subscribe, share, and tell a friend about islampodcasts.com as well as rate, review of iTunes.
If I were to ask you what Qad meant, I'm sure some of my respected elders would think that it's a nice meal that you have with chips. But I'm pretty sure for the most of you that Qad only means three words: Call of Duty. This game grossed $1 billion in the first 16 days of its release. Its release was promoted everywhere, on billboards, on TV adverts, and on the web. People literally queued up at night to get their copy of this game. For those of you who don't know this game, it's a game which is based on war. And you take the role of a specialist commando in the US Navy SEALs, in the British SAS, and the Russian Spetsnaz. But it is the online gameplay that got everyone so hyped up. They wanted to reach a high ranking. They wanted to try and get a prestige level ranking. Trying to get the best perks, the best guns, all those P90s, all those ACRs, the CM901s, the Type 95s and the UMPs. People would organize clans and groups online so that they may pay one another. Brothers and sisters, while we spend our time playing this game, a real war rages on. And this war is not one that you can turn off and go to your comfortable bed after Fajr or sit down for a nice hot meal. It's not just a game that you can play or turn off as you feel like you do with your PS3 or your Xbox. It affects breathing people, it affects men, it affects women, and it affects children. Like we have seen in the recent uprisings in Syria, where children are getting sent home in body bags, or they're getting sent home to their families with their limbs missing because their legs have been blown off. Just because of what? It's because they spoke the word of truth against a tyrant ruler. I ask you one question. Who toppled Gaddafi? Who toppled Mubarak? Who toppled Ben Ali? And bi-idhnillah, by Allah's permission, who will topple Bashar al-Assad? Was it not the youth? Was it not the youth of this ummah who sacrificed everything that they had to remove these regimes? They were facing tanks and bullets, and they had nothing. All they had was their bare chests and their faith in Allah. While the world looks on so impotent, they show a dedication against these tyrants. We are so eager to go far in this life, whether it is with your studies, whether it is with your work. But what about our urgency to answer the call of Allah, which is our call of duty? To worship Him in all aspects of our life, for standing for the truth and being the best examples in society. Without any further ado, I will pass you on to our first speaker, Brother Abdullah Vivash, who is an ex-Australian Marine who fought in the Vietnam War, and he also fought ex-heavyweight boxer Joe Frazier.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, brothers and sisters. Briefly, before I go into the subject regards Call of Duty, I'm going to just give you a brief outline of my life, to give you some understanding of what my personality was like, and how my life was molded. I come from a very violent background. My father was a very abusive man, and he was a drunkard. So I was getting this abuse at home. Also, I used to go to a Catholic school. A Catholic school in the 50s is not a very nice place, because the priests and the nuns there, I'll tell you now, are the most violent people that I've ever met. So my personality was being shaped with this abuse that I was getting on two levels. To the fact that I started to become or develop a similar personality to my father, which was that violent nature, that love of violence, to the fact that I was a school bully. I enjoyed nothing better. Because I used to lose time at school because of the beatings that I had, I wasn't, education-wise, I wasn't very good. I was what they called thick. And so, like kids do, they used to make fun of me. And my way to retaliate there was do what I did best, and that was just beat them up. And at the age of 15, because of the brutality that I was receiving at home, I left home. And I ran away from home at 15 because I got tired of the brutality of my father. And I went and lived in Sydney, in New South Wales, in Australia. And this was in the 60s, the early 60s, the time of free love, the pill, LSD, and all of that. And a 15-year-old on the streets of Sydney, you needed to be strong to survive. And it was in Sydney that I honed my skills at fighting and taking care of myself. Also along the way, losing a lot of compassion. So that's the brief makeup of what my personality was like. So moving on, my taking a theme from what the event is about, my first call of duty was on the 15th of February 1968, when I walked into the Army recruiting office in Sydney in Australia. And to say you're doing the math, it means I'm 61 on Wednesday. And so at the age of 17, I joined the Australian Army. By the time I was 17 and a half, I was 17 and 7 months old, I was stationed in Vietnam, where I did an 18-month tour of duty in Vietnam. And the personality that I had developed, looking at it, stood me in good stead in Vietnam, because I lacked any sort of compassion at all. Even seeing my friends killed, I didn't feel anything. Just, you know, lucky it wasn't me. The same again when it came to my actions, when I killed and who I killed. And I'll be honest, and I'm very honest when I give this talk, I've killed men, I've killed women, I've killed old women, I've killed children. Okay? That was my life. That was my life in Vietnam. And I embraced it. I enjoyed it there. It's like here amongst this room now, looking at the youth now. I ask, you know, what gadgets are you playing with? You probably pull out your iPhone or whatever. Whatever gadgets you got, even this game, they're the gadgets you play with. Right? When I was 17, just over 17, before I was even 18 years old, the gadget that I played with, the gadget that I loved, the gadget that I could make sing was an M60. Right? I was good. When I say I make it sing, and I mean I could make that weapon sing. I never missed. That was my gadget, and I loved it. And we used to come back from a tour. I used to polish it and clean it and probably look after it and revere it like you revere your phones or your cars or whatever. And even the experiences that I felt or I was involved in Vietnam, this slowly developed me to the point that I became no compassion at all. I had near-death experiences, and rather than linking that at all with anything, it was just, I'm glad it's not me. I'll tell you about one incident in Vietnam, and I'll tell you later on, when I finish talking, the relevance of this incident. We got into a firefight, and we were getting overwhelmed with NVRA, which is North Vietnamese regular troops. So it was decided that we would evac out. So they brought in Chinooks to evac us out. Myself and 26 of my colleagues boarded one evac and off we went. I'm sitting on the back and thinking, glad I'm out of that. That was getting a bit hairy. When there was a massive explosion and the rear rotor got taken out. And that Chinook just plummeted about 500-600 feet. On impact on the ground, because I was on the back, I got thrown clear. And the only injuries I suffered were scratches and bruising and a torn uniform. But about 20 seconds after impact, that Chinook just exploded. My 26 comrades there and four crew, they all died in that explosion. And I just sat there just watching it, just burning. Right? And again, because of that, I didn't feel any sadness at all. I'm just thinking, whoa, I'm glad I was the last one because I was sitting at the back. You know, and there were other near-death experiences that I had. The same again when we moved into villages that had been bombed and everything. You know, and looking at the dead. And there were, similar to what you see on the news now, there's a lot of civilian casualties. Okay? And I'll be honest with you, when they say we try and minimise civilian casualties, no, we don't. I go from my experience, no, we didn't, and you're in the way, tough. Okay? You either run fast or you're dead. But even walking through and seeing this, and I've seen a lot of dead children, a lot of dead women and everything, but there was nothing here. I felt nothing here. You know, just walk through. I remember one incident, and I look back on it now, and I feel so ashamed that person that I was then that could do that. And walking through, and where I was walking, there was a dead baby. And it would have been no more than about 8 or 9 months old. And it was in my way. And I kicked it out the way. And that's the sort of person that I was. And that's what I was like in Vietnam. And there was just no compassion, absolutely no compassion at all. And that carried on even when I came back from Vietnam. Because that violence was in me. I loved fighting. I used to test myself. I would walk into them when I used to drink. I would walk into a pub and I'd have a look around and I'd see 6 or 7 guys sitting around and I'm thinking, I could take them. So I'd go off and I'd pick a fight with the 7 of them because I knew that I was good. It was one thing that I was good at, these. All right? It wasn't academic, but I could use these. I couldn't hold a pen for my life, but I could use these. And that's how I got into boxing, because I got into trouble so much that my colonel of my regiment decided, well, if that's what you are, I'm going to put you in the boxing. And that's how my boxing started on that side of things there. And as I said, it was very good. My professional record is 39 fights, okay? Out of those 39 fights, I had 38 wins, 1 draw and a disqualification, okay? And I used to be, for 5 years running, I was the Army heavyweight champion, and I was the inter-services, which means the Navy, the RAF, and the Army. For 5 years running, and I was looking at propelling myself onto the international scene, and so this came about with the major fight that I had, and that's how I came to fight Joe Frazier, Sydney Arena, April 1978, fighting Joe Frazier on there, and that was a good for me. That was a good fight, you know. It was 15 hard rounds, and that's the one draw. That I had. And so, again, just absolutely loving it. But because of my personality at that time, I was still getting into trouble outside of the ring. An incident happened, and that avenue closed for me because I was stripped of my boxing license. So I couldn't progress anymore. So, again, liking the fast life, liking the money, liking the cars, liking the women. I, because of my skills, I was approached by a family. Okay? I don't think I need to paint a picture of you when I say I was approached by a family. I'm not talking about Mr. Patel down the road wanting me to go into his chip shop or something. But I was approached by a family, and purely because of the nature that I was, and I became, for a family in Sydney, I became an enforcer for them. And the personality and everything that I had, it enabled me to do that job without any compassion at all. You know, I remember an incident there where I beat a bloke half to death in front of his wife. And the fact that his wife and children were there, it didn't worry me, right? I had a job to do. You owe money, pay your money, or I'll be back. So that's what my life was revolving around, okay? Women to me were a commodity, okay? The lifestyle that I lived with drew women. The fact I used to box, the fact that I used to work on the doors, the fact that I was a strong, powerful man fighting, that used to draw women. The fact I had money, that draws women. So the lifestyle that this dunya offers you, I drank from the cup with gusto. Really, and absolutely loved it. So we go talking about, so how does somebody with all of that personality behind them sort of change? And this comes into what I call my second call of duty. And my reversion into Islam, it wasn't a conscious one. I wasn't looking at changing my life. I liked my lifestyle. Yeah, it had all the hassles that it has, but no problems if I have a problem, you know, and I needed a pen stop, I just pick on some poor sucker and just give him a beating. That's it, I feel good now. You know, some people use alcohol to get to shut it out. You know, some people take drugs to shut it out. I didn't, I just pick on something. Oh, you look nice, come over here, we'll give you a bash. We won't do it though, I've said, so you'll be right. But that's what it was like. So I wasn't looking at changing my life. But at that time, I was working at Kingston University on their security team. And 60% of the intake were Asian, but 40% of that intake were Muslims. Now, in my day-to-day dealings with people there, I had no problems dealing with whatever nationality, dealing with the Indians or whatever, I had no problems. But when it came to the Muslims, there was something different. All right? Again, I'm not picking on you. Had an issue with you, I would be talking to you, come here, you might need to take details and everything. Look down at my book, look up. I haven't got just him, I've got the whole front row. So all right, just carry on doing. Next thing I look up, I haven't just got the front row, I've now got the second row. They just seem to draw in, and it's nothing to do with you. Just go away. And the answer I got back was, no bro, we're here to support him, he's our brother. All right? Or the same if I had to speak to sisters at that time. Okay? It's the same thing. No, we're here to support our sister. I'm thinking, what is this? You know, if it happened with anybody else, okay, whether it was with an English person or whatever, another one of the foreign students or whatever, because he's in trouble, they want to get as far away as possible. But the Muslims, no, we're there. We're here to support. We ain't going anywhere. You do what you have to do. And that intrigued me. So I went to the library and I got a book on Islam. And I just sort of have a read of it, thinking, oh, that will help me. That will help me. And one of the first things that struck me, the book that I got out, was that what I thought Islam was incorrect. Or what a Muslim, I just thought it was a religion. But the book that I got out, it's talking of jihad. It's talking of the spiritual side, and it was talking of a demon. Oh, I need to know. I'm not understanding the book, because I said I'm not the brightest of people, but I'm not understanding the book, so I think I need to find out. So I knew some Muslim brothers that I've got to speak to there, so I knew to speak with them. And so I approached them, and I'll be honest with you, I didn't see them for a week. And when we did start speaking, I said to them, you know, how come it took you a week to get back? And they just said, bro, we knew of your background. We're just thinking, if we start destroying what this guy believes in, this guy's going to destroy us. But Hamdan, may Allah be pleased with them, they had the courage to talk to me. And this is why my reversion, I look at it, it was so different. Because when we sat down and I started to ask my questions and everything, they answered my questions, telling me what this deen is, you know, that it's a way of life and it encompasses an economic and a foreign policy and all of that. And the spiritual side is our prayer and our hajj and all of that. And then they started to go in about, you know, what you need to be doing. You need to be looking at yourself. You know, that you need to understand what your purpose here is in life and everything. So they, you know, again, they took the courage. They started to attack, but not attack, they started to dismantle everything that I believed in. And this is why, when I talk to people about it, and I smile, that the reversion, you know, to me was some sort of miracle. Because instead of, you know, somebody telling me that I'm wrong, somebody telling me and tearing my lifestyle apart, I had one response. But with these guys, I didn't. For some reason, I listened to what they had to say. And I took it on board. And I said, coming from a Catholic school, I know the Bible back to front. If it was a halfies in Christianity, I would be one because I know the Bible back to front. So I went away for a few days. And then I came back with what I thought was a brilliant argument. And these brothers sat there, and I must admit, they did sit nervously. So I gave them my argument, hoping to destroy what they had. They listened patiently to what I had to say. And then slowly, they started to dissect it, and they started to pull it apart. And then they started to move on to my personality, because they said to me, why do you do that? And I said, oh, that's just me, that's just the way that Allah's made me. You know, that's just the way that God made me. I'm just a violent person. And then they said, well, no, you're not. You know. And then they started to go into my environment and showing me that I've become a product of my own environment. You know, like we do sound, I've had talks where they say that if you hang around the blacksmith, you'll start to smell like a blacksmith. And if you hang around the perfume counter, you'll start smelling like, you know. So they started to explain that. And then something within me changed. So instead of going from, okay, this is now going to help me in my job, it's, okay, I need to know more. Okay. And then I was going back, because I was about 30 miles away, so I was going back to my place. And I started to look, for the first time I started to look at my past, and at certain instances, like the one with the child and the other, and I'm looking at it and I'm thinking, and for the first time in my life, it was a night there, I just sat there, and all of a sudden, I just became, I'm just thinking, you're not a nice person. So I rang Australia, and I started to speak to my mates and everything. And I said, look, listen here, you know, this and that, you know, all you guys agree with me. And again, for the first time in their lives, they became honest, and they said, no, the reason we agree with you and everything is because we're frightened of you. It's as simple as that. So I thought, right, well, what is this thing that it's for the first time in my life making me think? So I went back and I told them that I wanted to know more. And this is when what the brothers referred to, the culture, I started to receive the culture. I started to go through, you know, my reason for being here, my purpose in life, my the point that I need to, you know, question things and understand things, and why was I here. And then the sealer for me was when they went through proof of Quran with me. And that sealed it for me. So the point is that I found that it was nearly 5 months, I'm not talking about a week or 2 weeks, after nearly five months, that I became totally convinced. And again, this is how strong Islam is. I went in with them one day and I said, you convince me. And 15 minutes later, I was at Kingston Mosque and I had taken Shahada. And my whole life changed, my whole personality changed, how I looked upon people changed. To the point that, again, after about 3 or 4 months of that, one of the brothers who actually coached me came up to me and said, you know, Abdullah, gave me the name Abdullah, you know, it's recommended that you get married. And it's a bit more courage this time, because I'm a Muslim, he knows I can't hit him. He says, you're getting a bit old, you need to take a wife. So he recommended a sister. And the highest praise to me, the sister he recommended, was his sister. And subhanAllah, we've been married coming up to 15 and a half years now. Okay? And so I started to, again, take on the culture, learning how to pray and everything, and the tranquility and everything. And the calmness, for the first time in my life, the calmness came over me. And Gabe, you remember the story about Vietnam? My wife and I went to Hajj. I also did Hajj after about 2 years, went to Hajj. And on the evening when we were at Arafat, when we went up to the mount to pray, all day long, helicopters have been going up and down, all day long. All right, the Saudis keep a very close eye on them. But they're all single blade helicopters. So come sunset and go up to Arafat, go to pray, and just before I'm praying, hear a helicopter coming out of the distance. And it was a very heavy rotary sound, and I recognized it. And for the first time that day, just out of the cloud, came a Chinook. And I'll be honest with you, I wept, because it was like Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala was saying to me, Abdullah, look where you are now, and remember where you were. And I took a photo of that, and it's in my album. And so I embraced Islam, and I embraced it wholly. But that's not the end of it. Because this is where we come to what this talk is about here. It's that call of duty. I haven't become Muslim. I haven't become a better person. Okay, that's the end of it. I now do this. You know, I do talks. I talk to the youth around our areas and everything to explain to them, you know, the importance of understanding their deen, the importance of working within their deen. Because at the end of the day, just in this room alone, would any of you know what to do, right, if a non-Muslim came up to you and asked you, tell me about Islam, what is Islam about? Or would any of you know the answers when you start getting questions? You know, so this is why it's important for you to embrace your call of duty. Accept what you have to do. Understand your deen. I'm so passionate about this now, and trying to get people to understand their deen. Okay? Because by doing that, you can contradict misconceptions about it. If you become politically aware, okay, when people talk to you negatively about what's happening in Syria or what happened in Tunisia, if you become politically aware and embrace your deen, alright, accept your call of duty, you're able to counter those arguments. That's why it's so important. You know, not just, oh, it's Ramadan, I better pray now and then for the rest of the year, not do anything at all. Where I work, I mean, I'm the only Muslim where I work. The rest of them are English, all right? Probably related to a lot of people in the BNP, the EDL. But the point is, when I hear them have a conversation and they're being derogatory or they're voicing misconceptions, I just don't walk past. I go up to them and say, oh, I've just heard you. Do you mind if I correct you? What you're saying or your understanding is wrong. And because I've embraced that call, and it continues all the time, I still receive the culture and everything. I'm able to counter that. And inshallah, maybe one day one of them might come to me and say, look, I want something, I want to know more. So this is why this talk today is so important, and it's so important for you, the youth. You know, you can't leave it up to old men like me all the time. Right? It's up to you. The impact that you have, okay? You just don't know. You know, especially on the elders. You know, if suddenly you're starting talking to your uncles and your aunties and everything, the impact you have. And it's looking at what's going on. You know, I look at what I was, And I think to myself, when I look at my young brothers in the Muslim land, would I have the courage to stand in front of the tank and throw a stone? Would I have the courage to stand in front of fully armed soldiers with every weapon conceivable, shouting slogans, shouting Allah Akbar. When I had the courage to do that, knowing that I could be killed, you know, and it puts, for me, in perspective what I did in Vietnam. I used to think, yeah, I was the hard man, I was the hero, you know, I was tough, you know, because of the way and the actions that I had, and I'm looking at it, I said, no, I wasn't. No. The courage is there. The courage is with these youngsters. You know, I won't go on too much about it because I'm sure Brother, you know, will say it. But for me, understanding Islam wasn't hard. It's probably a lot of you say, oh no, we can't do that, you need an imam or anything to do it. It's not. I was given books, and all you need to do is read. Anything you don't understand, there are people out there that can give you the answers. It's the same when you get a new gadget. What's the first thing you do? You read the manual. Islam, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, has provided us with the manual. Read it. Understand it so that you can go out of there. You can defend Allah's deen. Okay? You can defend the misconceptions that they have that we oppress our sisters and our mothers. Okay? And inshallah, maybe, because one of them might come up and I'm going to embrace. Because if you can just get one of them to revert, you know, there's a tree planted in the heaven for you. Okay? So I'll end up here now. As I said, if you've got any other questions, I'm sure you have. But it's important that you, so I reiterate this, come to understand what your deen is all about. Okay? You need to be politically aware, you know, and inshallah, you know, I hope maybe somebody like me would approach you one day and then you have that knowledge and that conviction to turn that person like the brothers turned me and bring them into this deen of ours. So,
inspiring talk.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. Podcasts on current events, Islamic guidance, Quran tafsir, and seerah are available at islampodcasts.com as well as on iTunes. Rate, review, and comment and let us know how we can grow in our knowledge to better serve our community. Please subscribe, share, and tell a friend about islampodcasts.com.